Hi, welcome to the Miles From Home podcast. I'm your host, David Miles. Great to have you here with me. I'm coming to you from Fredericton, New Brunswick. And today I have a conversation with songwriter Ken Yates. I dig Ken Yates. I've been listening to Ken Yates a ton lately, and I thought it would be suitable to therefore have a conversation with him, particularly where I was at this peak fandemonium. I've been listening to his record Cerulean a ton. His record before that is called Quiet Talkers, also really good. He's the kind of artist that you can just put him on one of the streaming services if you want, or buy his records. You're not going to go wrong. There's not a weak song out there. I really think he is an undiscovered gem of the songwriting world in Canada. I mean, I think people are picking up on what he's putting down. Definitely a lot of people know how good he is, but still, considering how good he is, I think there are a lot of people who have yet to discover Ken Yates. So I was excited. I was excited to have this conversation. I love doing this. I really do, and it's nice to be back in the swing of things. I took a little break, and now I'm back. I decided to go back in time and bring back the old theme song, too, because it just feels right, doesn't it? It just feels right. It's like a wrestling intro, you know, getting into the ring and bom 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 bom. Woo! That's right. That's actually from my instrumental record, That Tall Distance, and it seems to work as a theme song. So it's great to be back. I think you're going to dig this conversation with Ken Yates. We do get a little nerdy. We get nerdy with it, but that's what I do. And particularly, I was really curious to talk to Ken about his experience at Berklee. He went to Berklee, you know, one of the most famous music schools in the whole world. So I was kind of curious to know how that influenced his songwriting. Songwriting is something that we often think of as something that we're just born with, the ability. So I'm always curious to know how it is taught, how it is instructed, particularly at one of the best music schools in the world. So that was very enlightening. And also, I wanted to get technical. He's a master of verses, writing great verses. So I wanted to dig into his process, how he thinks about writing lyrics, how he thinks about writing verses as opposed to choruses and structure and songs and all that kind of stuff. Now, I know you might not think that's going to be the most interesting conversation, but I will tell you, in fact, I think it is. I think it was pretty enlightening because Ken is a bright, bright light. Really smart dude. Very funny guy. He loves the outdoors. And we share a lot in common. As you know, if you've listened to the podcast, I love being in the woods. I love the snow. I love skiing. I love snowboarding. And so talking to Ken, oh my gosh, it was like meeting an old friend for the first time. It was unreal. And it's nice. It's really nice. Part of these conversations that I enjoy so much is that I make friends. I make real lasting friendships by having this podcast. And I appreciate the opportunity to do that. And I appreciate to have the relationship with you, the listener. So thank you so much for being here with me through all these episodes. I hope you've been enjoying them. If you've been going back to the past episodes, I've had a blast doing this. So please share them because we're going to keep it going for years to come with your help. So let's get right to it. Ken Yates, dig it. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm on Instagram at David Miles. I'm on Twitter at Miles David Miles with the Y. Why? Because I love you and I appreciate you. Let's get into it with Ken Yates on the Miles From Home podcast. Buddy, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
We did it, man.
We did it. Getting to meet almost in person.
Almost, yeah. Yeah,
I appreciate you doing this. I've been on a Ken Yates tear, buddy. I have been listening to a lot of your music over the last 6 months, especially. Like, it's just awesome.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I appreciate that. I'm a fan. I've been listening to you since well before you knew who I was. So that's great.
Making me feel old, bro. That's cool. I appreciate that. No, it's really, really great stuff. I'm not even really sure where I want to start, but I'm just glad that you agreed to do this. And I really do appreciate it. I'm always curious, especially with artists that I love their music, but I don't really know much about them, you know? Of course, I know Jim Bryson, who you've worked with many times, and now you're working with Dan Ledwell, and obviously a great friend of mine as well. But let's just go back. Let's go back to the early days. Did you grow up in the Ottawa Valley?
No, I grew up in London, Ontario.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Ottawa thing is just purely a gym connection. So
wow, okay, and so where do you live now?
I'm in Creemore, Ontario, which is a small town just outside of Collingwood, which is about an hour and a half north of Toronto. So yeah, my wife and I moved here a couple years ago during the pandemic. So it was a...
And you had moved from
the
where?
Classic. From Toronto. We were in Toronto for the past 10 years or so. So yeah, we did the typical city slicker move to the country. So yeah. We're liking it. And you're in New Brunswick, right?
I did the same thing. Yeah.
So where are you now?
I was in Halifax for about 15 years, and then I moved home. I mean, my hometown is Fredericton.
Okay.
But it's funny. There's like so many parallels. When I see your posts and stuff, I'm looking at it, and I'm going, man, this is hilarious, because like I'm seeing it. Obviously, Creemore is close to Collingwood, so it's close to skiing. You're in like the snow area of Southern Ontario.
Yes, we are in pretty much the only ski area that – well, I guess Ottawa has some skiing, but – kind of close to Blue Mountain, and that's how we knew this this area. Is just my wife and I had been coming up here skiing for the past basically her whole life, but when I started dating her, we would come up. Her parents have a place up here, so that's how we knew the area, and always kind of talked about moving up here. Never really thought about it seriously, but then the pandemic kind of gave us some time to think about where we wanted to be.
And how has it been?
I love it. We both love it, but it suits my lifestyle. I've really never liked living in the city. I was always we were barely ever even in the city on weekends. We would always just try to get out somewhere with green space. And I was never really suited for city living anyway. So it's right in my wheelhouse, just being...
But you grew up in London, didn't you? I mean, like, London's a pretty big city.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the suburbs in London.
Okay.
But again, I would just, most weekends, I would just try to get out in the woods where I could. So this is definitely more suitable
to my interests. I relate big time. I do find it really funny, because I found the same thing. There was a point at which I was going to Montreal a lot working, and I found myself like all the time in Montreal, I was walking around the mountain. Yeah. Like I was in the woods on the mountain being like, this is the best. And I'm like,
totally.
And I love Montreal. I got tons of time for it. I still love going, but it was at that point where I realized like, maybe I don't need, not that Halifax is a huge city, but maybe, I seem to be seeking this out wherever I am, right in the middle of Montreal. I'm like, I'm going into the woods for the whole day and then popping out. And I'm like, okay, maybe this is a sign, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm just one of those people. I don't, like, there's things I miss about the city, of course, like, especially we don't really have much takeout around here. But I just think I'm not one of those people who gets like a buzz from being surrounded by people. I get more out of, walking in the woods by myself. So I don't know what that says about me, but I'm a lot happier to do that every day and not have to just seek it out in like small, bits and pieces. And of course, like our jobs kind of keep us connected to city life and seeing lots of people anyway. So I still feel like I have that in my life, but I'm a lot more, a little more at peace with just like having a bit more space. And I'm sure you can relate to that.
I do. And I found it. I mean, it is, it's like, we have a very social job. And in fact, part of the decision was that I felt like if I was going to be able to do it for the long haul, a lot of these conversations too are about how to do it for the long haul. I'm more interested in like how to make a career of it. That's the real trick. Like, it's one thing to do it for a couple of years, another thing to do it for 30 or 40 or longer. And I started to realize in my own case that I needed to make sure that like my time off was restorative. So I had like the capacity to be social. To want to be in the merch line, to want to be shaking hands, and to be like, have the capacity to be like that guy, ultra social and ready to go. And for me, that restorative time was spent in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I used to feel bad about it. I used to feel guilty. Like if I wanted to like take a weekend off to go like, on a canoe trip or something. But I think I learned that it's the only way to like turn off the existential dread and the like, just turn off both your artist brain and your being so connected to everything now. Right. And I realized after a while, like maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, like that I was really benefiting from it and I should stop feeling, you know, feeling bad for doing it. Cause you know, I think we always have that guilt of like, we're not working hard enough or, you know, there's a million things we could be doing all the time. And so anytime you are not doing that, you're just thinking, you know, what should I be doing to kind of further my progress here? But eventually I just said, you know what? I think this stuff is doing me good. So I should just do it without any guilt and recognize that it's kind of a important part of my life.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, that's so interesting because a lot of, you know, a lot of what I feel like I've learned is that things, time that is productive doesn't look productive.
Yes, totally. I feel like I spent half my career, you know, I've been doing this about 13 years now. And I feel like half of my, half of that was just filling the space to feel busy, but not necessarily actually making any progress or like looking out for my, you know, my physical and mental health during that time. So that's been a nice little realization, especially in the past couple of years. But yeah.
And do you think it's had a positive effect on your output, like your art?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think so. I've always been like, I mean, fairly prolific. Like I'm writing all the time, but I'm not necessarily like writing a song every day, but I'm always trying to, you know, get in a little bit of time. It takes me forever to write anything, but I'm always writing, and I found that that's just kind of focused me a little bit more. Even if I'm like not putting in as many hours, the hours are a bit more focused, I'm finding.
Yeah. Interesting. And so what does it look like? What is your creative time? What do you do to kind of create that space? When you say you're chipping away at a song, is it when you're doing other things, or is it generally like that's you by yourself, or is it collaborative? Is it in the studio? How does it look?
No, it's usually me by myself. Yeah, just in bits and pieces. I find like if I have like a full day or a full week or something where I don't have much else going on, and I always say like, man, that's going to be great. I'm going to write so many songs. I'm going to just be creative. I never get anything from that. I always get it in like small chunks. So now I'm learning that if I sit down and I'm not getting anything, it's better just to put it down and go do something else. And, you know, like for me, it's always lyrics. Like it takes me forever to write any lyrics. So for the most part, I'll have like 5 or 6, like guitar parts or melodies that I just, you know, if the lyrics aren't coming, I just have to put it down and go do something else. Where again, that, you know, a walk in the woods helps with that too, because sometimes that actually kind of focuses your brain and doing something else sort of, you know, unlocks your unconscious sometimes and allows like thoughts and ideas to come in there. So yeah, it's mostly now it's just like, you know, sitting down for 30 minutes, going to do something else, coming back to it, and just that's kind of my process. Every once in a while, you know, something will hit you and you'll be able to write a song in a couple of hours, but that doesn't seem to happen much these days. What about you? What's your process like?
Yeah, it is a bit like that. You know, I wish that they all came super quick. You know, it varies. Every once in a while, like every once in a while they do come quick, but it's a grueling process. You know, I mean, there really is like, it's one of those things, and I've been trying to think about it a little bit more and kind of express what it looks like. But to me, it's like almost like a glimmer. You get a little glimmer of where you want to head. You have a direction, you have a sense, there's a light in the distance. I always kind of describe it as a light in the distance, and you kind of go, oh, that's exciting. And then you move towards it. And sometimes you get to that light real quick. And other times you got to like hack away with a machete. That's the work, right? Like that's the work part. Yes. Like I remember I read something from John Mayer that said, you know, I don't necessarily like writing. I like having written.
You know? Yes.
And like I kind of like that, you know, like it's true. I do like writing. I love the process, but I love it when it's moving. I love it when I feel like I'm moving towards that light quickly. But that's not, it would be too easy if it was like that all the time. I mean, I'm the same way. I will just work and work and hack away until I feel like I'm closer to that light. And then sometimes the light disappears and you're like, oh man, okay, maybe it wasn't as exciting. And then other times it comes in another direction and I move. So it does look like that. You know, I think sometimes, you know, speaking to the idea of like, if it's not coming easy, where to go? I was just thinking about this last night. You know, I think maybe when I was younger, I would just sit there And so sometimes I don't know if it is necessary just to like, I've just read Haruki Murakami's book on becoming a writer. It's called Novelist as Vocation. Beautiful, amazing. And he works every day. It's like 6 hours, 8,000 words or whatever it is. Like he writes, he just like methodically sits and works and then runs for like an hour and a half every day. And
right.
It's totally, you know, I thought, oh, that's really interesting. You know, that's his process. I don't know. I'm kind of more like you where I go at it. And if the light is shining, then I move towards it. And then if I feel like if I'm staring at it too hard, I'm not getting closer. Like
right.
Often
yeah,
the gold is in the periphery.
Yeah. Right. It's like a wild animal sometimes. You don't want to stare it straight in the eyes. You got to like move around it a bit. wait for it to come to you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a dance. It is a dance. And so I think when I get too uptight, and I see this a lot with younger artists too, you know, like with artists in general, and when we're talking amongst each other or if I'm working in a different kind of role, that often it is that intensity. If there's a real intensity, like I must do this and it needs to be this, it doesn't land where you expect it. There's this whole mysterious process that you kind of have to embrace in songwriting. Yes. So it's like showing up. You got to show up, but it's a funny thing, especially for those who are like, I mean, it sounds like you're the same way, where like I'm filled with guilt when it comes to work.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all are, right? I think we all struggle with that. And once you realize everyone's struggling with that, it becomes a little bit easier to.
That's why I have a podcast, Ken. Yeah, that's literally, right. It's like I get to share my struggles with other people. And then I'm like, wait, I'm not alone. This is great to hear, man. You have to take a break after a half an hour. Tremendous.
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, what's scary right now is like normally I would have, because I put out my last album in June. And normally during the whole release process, I would have written, you know, half a record by the time the new record comes out. So I'd have like, I'd be well on my way to something new. And this time, for whatever reason, I went through a bit of a dry spell with this record and just kind of went months without writing anything. And now, of course, we're 6 months away, 6 months out from the release of that record. And people are like, so what's next? I'm like, shit, man, I gotta get to work. But again, like you said, like it doesn't just happen. It's just kind of, you just kind of gotta trust the process and hope that the river starts running again.
To me, man, you are speaking. It's actually exactly the case with me right now for the first time.
Is it? Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder if it's not because we're coming out of this strange time and we're, you know, there's a lot of other, like there was something about the pandemic that was very focused, you know. Yeah. I mean, I actually was, it's like I had to run towards the creative process because it was my solace.
Yes.
You know, it was my place of peace, if you will. And it hadn't really, in other ways, it hadn't had the same role. It had always been obviously extraordinarily important to my state of mind, but it was the pandemic, I think, that maybe made it more clear to me how important it was to have that outlet, to be a creative person, to make music. And I got right into it. You know, I don't think I've ever enjoyed it so much, you know, or needed it so much. And now I'm coming out and there's all these like, there's just logistical differences. You know, my kids are at school, for instance, which, you know, is, right. We're doing activities and we're out, you know, so there's just, it's been a different thing. And I'm slower too. I'm slower too, man, for sure.
Did you find that you immediately like, when the pandemic hit, I feel like everybody was like, great, we have all this time for writing and being creative. I found it took me months to actually settle into it. And once I did, I kind of hit my groove with it. But were you like, were you diving right into it immediately or?
Not really. No, I mean, yeah. I got pretty, there was obviously just the first couple months of just being like, what the heck? What's going on? And I had to make sure that I was there for my kids because they were home. So that was kind of the priority. But at the same, and I didn't know how to record. I didn't know how to do any of this stuff. I didn't know how to do anything. Yeah. Zero.
We're in the same boat, except I don't have kids. So I found it hard enough just to adjust to having a wife home. And this was part of our decision to move out of the city too, was, you know, we had a fairly large space in Toronto, but there were no doors or anything. So she was on work calls all day. And I was like, I can't even play guitar or anything. Yeah. So I'm sitting there with headphones on trying to write, but it just kind of, I had to rework my process, and that was hard enough. But I can imagine having kids at home made it.
Well, I was lucky because I had a little outbuilding, so it saved me. Nice. You know, so I really can't complain. I really had a good, considering I'd be with them during the day, and then at night I would go out and basically just like let out all my feelings. But a lot of it was exploration. Awesome. And I didn't know, you know, I didn't know if it was going to come out as a record or what we were doing. It was just more about fooling around and trusting the instinct. But it was fairly important for me to do that and to kind of reconnect with my instinct. But I am finding it interesting now to be back in it and back out touring, doing these things and being like, okay, yeah, I feel like, just like you said, man, I would usually always have something going on.
Yeah, in a way, it's harder now than it was, you know, during the peak of the pandemic, because now it's like the pressure's on again, right? I think the beauty of that time was just that I think a lot of us were just making music just because it's what we do, right? It's just we weren't making it for other people per se. At least I wasn't. That was a nice time for me to just like have some space just to enjoy the process a little bit and stop thinking about like what people are going to think about it. And other people will decide this, but I think I got some of my best work out of that, with just like turning off, you know, all that outside noise and actually just enjoying the process of making music.
Yeah. And how do you maintain that now as you move forward? You know,
that's tricky. Yeah. I don't know, man. Yeah. It's definitely hard right now with just getting back to it. And are you back out on the road at all? Or
I am.
Yeah,
I am. How's that been going? I mean, not much, not to the same degree. My domestic duties are more significant for sure. So, you know, having me around it's just so difficult for me to be out from a family perspective. So I went out in the fall, and I'm going out in the spring. We're doing a Quebec tour in the spring. So it's kind of like it's just a little bit more. I can't say yes to everything. I'm out a lot less than I was before, but I'm out. And it does change things. It does, you know, it also motivates things, you know. There's also the element of, like, you come back from shows. I don't know if you find this, but you also are, like, for me, it's always informed the writing to it. Not, I know there's a danger in kind of overthinking what the audience is going to think, but there's also sometimes, like, I like the show. And so sometimes I'm like, ooh, I need something that has a bit more pace, or I want something that involves the band in this way or has these kind of moments. And so it does kind of inform, it always informed. I would come back from a tour and write.
Yeah. You know. That's so interesting. Yeah, it was the same for me. And in a way, I think it dictated my music in some bad ways, especially earlier on, because for the first few years, I was just trying to make a living. And so I was just saying yes to everything and just being on the road as much as possible and just trying to get by, which meant I was doing a lot of like private stuff, a lot of house concert shows. And that kind of dictated the sound of the music, because you're playing in living rooms to mostly strangers. And I wrote all these songs that were like almost just suited for that environment, which was really strange looking back. And it was a lot folkier than stuff I was listening to. And which is just strange. But I think it is good. I've found now, like, I released this record without playing any of the songs live for anybody. And that was also difficult in its own way, because it's like, you know, you need that energy from people to kind of figure out like which songs are even good, right? Like sometimes it's hard to be your own judge of what's the best song, and having you can feel that energy when you play live. So that it's been nice getting back to that and just seeing like, oh, okay, this song seems to feel pretty good when I play it live. But yeah, it's interesting how that does dictate the sound of the song sometimes. Well, I'm trying to stop doing that.
How close were you I find this really funny. Rick Rubin talks about that, right? The idea of just like, you really can't guess what the audience wants. It's really our job is to kind of get a sense of what we want to create and be able to express that kind of clearly, you know, with a small group of people. But like the moment you start really over guessing what the audience is going to want, you're generally going to get it wrong. It's very, very hard to guess. And you do get those moments where you can play a song live and you do know, okay, the energy's, you know, the energy's dropping a little bit here. I can tell that this feels long, so it's probably a little long. Maybe I got to cut the second verse or whatever. Like, you know, these kind of things. I do find that really interesting. But I'm in this weird balance position where. But how did your guessing go? Like, when you make this record, you don't have an audience. And then all of a sudden you put it out. You haven't played for anybody. Were the songs that you thought were going to hit people the songs that hit people? Like, how was your barometer?
No, it's never with the songs that I think are going to hit people. It never is. But I think, I do think that it was really important for me to make a record without having played the songs live a million times, because it also just dictated, like, we just had more options of how to arrange it and what to do. Like, normally if you're playing a new song on the road and you've just kind of, it's set in its way now, like you've molded how you're going to play it and how you're going to sing it. So it was actually really nice to not have any of that and just kind of try a few different things with Jim. And I didn't really have a direction in my head of where I thought these songs should go. But yeah, no, the songs people are connecting to are never the songs that it's so hard to know which songs are going to connect with people, but it's never the one that I think it's going
to
be.
Yeah. I know this is, and it's a great thing to remember. It's a great thing to remember. And I do agree that idea of being too locked into a song, it kind of limits its potential, because you're limiting it to the potential of what it's going to be in front of people. But you do also, you tour a fair amount solo, right?
Yeah, it's mostly been solo I've just started doing a few full band things, but yeah, for the most part, it's been purely solo, which is its own challenge now that, you know, with this newest record, it's a lot more band arrangements and I'm finding it a little more difficult to play some of these songs solo without having those elements there. But I mean, when you play solo, sometimes you're just standing up there being like, is anybody really like this right now? You know? Yeah, and then you kind of need that feedback after, and you go, oh, okay, that went all right. But
well, especially if you've imagined the songs as full band things, then you get out there and you're going solo. It's a really important thing to be able to do. You know, it kind of shows the strength of the song.
Yeah, you hope so. But sometimes it's when you're just alone up there, you're just like, man, is this going okay? You don't have that feedback from other people on stage. Are you mostly full band, or
I'm mostly three of us. It's been a long time. There's been Alan and Kyle and I, the trio, and it's just been I've been so lucky, because to me it was like it was malleable, it was intimate, but it would work in a lot of different venues. It wasn't drums, so the stage volume was really low. It was very singing focused, still is.
Yeah.
And I was not alone. Like I just realized quite quickly, even though I do love being alone, and I do solo shows, and they scare me, and that I enjoy them once I've done them.
Yeah.
I like having done them, not necessarily doing them.
Right. You know? Exactly.
I like having done them because they do feel cool, but I've been pretty, you know, that was always a big thing for me when I thought about being on the road for a long time, even just having one person, sometimes even just having a sound person. Now I've been thinking about that. Like if I go out solo, it'll be like, I'll still bring one person in, a lot of it, not only because it makes the show better, but because I have some company. So I have someone at the end of the night that can be like, okay, let's kind of like at least have a chat about how that went, or like express something to someone. It can get lonely quick for me.
Absolutely. No, I mean, touring is super lonely. It's again, like I think, you know, I like having those moments, you know, moments of isolation to myself when I choose to have them. But yeah, being on the road is, and I've mostly been solo on the road. And yeah, it's tough when you're in the car all day and then you get to the venue and then you're just sitting waiting by yourself. And then you got to stand in front of a bunch of people and then be alone after. So to not have that, like, just like somebody to talk to about things.
It's a strange thing. It's definitely very strange. Existence.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's very strange. It is,
but it also makes a lot of sense. It's really important from the song perspective. Audiences love it. Like, I mean, heck, it's not exactly cheap to be touring right now. So it's extremely, like, it's becoming almost a vital reality to be able to go out solo, I'm finding.
Well, I mean, that's been my issue. It's just, it's the only way I've been able to just make a living doing this for this long. And, but I mean, I have been, my last few shows were full band shows, and man, it was just so nice. Cause I realized, and I think I had to develop this. Like I find the banter part tough, in between songs, but when you're playing solo, like you have to do it. It's just a part of it. You can't just be up there and I know you still need to do some banter with full band, but it felt so good to like not feel like I had to spend half the show talking to the
it's
audience.
Very different.
Or
it's
some,
very
sometimes different. It feels like babysitting when you're playing solo, right? You're like, okay, well, we're gonna get up now and we're gonna go down. And you're gonna be quiet now, and now you're gonna be loud. So sometimes it feels a little bit like you're having to babysit them through it, especially if it's an audience that may not know you. And for a lot of my shows lately, I've been support on stuff, so that's even more of a challenge because it's like you guys definitely don't know who I am, so I have to charm you with my songs and also charm you with my banter, and that's always been a challenge for me to like develop that. But I mean, that's one thing that the house concerts and stuff were good for, was kind of developing that skill. But mm-hmm. I do love having other people on stage, and I feel like you don't have to tell a story between each song. You know,
it's a very different art.
Yeah.
It's a very different show. You know, in fact, I've seen some of my favorite shows ever. The band didn't say anything.
Right.
And I'm a guy who likes to chat. Like I banter. I do that. It's part of the show. You know, I mean, it's been a huge part of developing a career for me, has been chatting with the audience and doing all that. But then I watch these shows and I'm like, wow, that was a very moving show and nothing was said. I saw War on Drugs. It was just miraculous to me because everything that was transmitted to the audience was musical.
Right.
And everybody felt it. They weren't told to feel it. They weren't told, okay, this is this. It's like, no, the crescendo in this guitar solo is going to be so rad and the lights are going to be so awesome when it opens up into the final like climax of this musical moment that everybody is going to cheer at the same time. Because of great composition.
Yeah.
I was just yes. It's not like, it just felt so different from the solo show where you kind of go like, oh yeah, this is a song about, and it's great. Like it's a different art, but then all of a sudden I was watching this other thing where I was like, oh, that is rad. I love that I'm just part of this big compositional wave, and its strength is built on the fact that it's like great songs, great playing, great production, like great display of all of these things, and it moves people just by the music.
Absolutely. Yeah. What I was so excited just to be able to go from one song straight into the next when I did a couple of full band shows, I was like, this is awesome. I don't have to stop everything and be like, you know, tell a story about my neighbor, you know. I was psyched. Now I understand, like, you've got to engage still, but that's never been a thing that comes naturally to me, even though I've been playing solo for 13 years. It's just something I've had to work on. But sometimes I'm standing up there and I'm talking and I'm just like, dude, just shut up and play the song. You know, like sometimes it gets away from you and you start kind of pandering a little bit.
Well, I think it's nerves. I think it's nerves about filling space, and you know, space is a funny thing because it scares us.
Right.
I felt like I didn't take a drink of water for 15 years on stage, not a single drink of water.
But it's always there, right?
It's always there.
I do the
it's
same
like
thing.
Absolutely,
it's always there.
An essential element is to have that water bottle full, just in case. How many times do I go to the water bottle? Never. Zero, because I'm scared of taking the time to even do that. I don't change guitars. I hardly tune. I play guitars that stay in tune at all costs.
That's amazing. Somebody actually commented on this recently that I had a water bottle there and I took one tiny little baby sip during the show, and they were like, you took the smallest little sip of water during the show.
It's a life jacket, man. You don't need to use it every time.
But I'm killing myself now because I wrote all these new songs in this weird messed up low C tuning, and so now I feel like I need the extra guitar, but I also need to retune a bunch, and I'm really kicking myself for doing that, because now I need like the three guitars and I need to retune some of them.
Yeah.
So that's been interesting.
Well, it's all, I mean, that's it though, is that we are allowed more room than we think we are. I think.
Yes.
I really do. I've my thing now is more like, if we are comfortable, the audience is comfortable. If we're at ease, the audience is at ease. And there can be a lot more space there than we think. In fact, when we're on stage and there's nerves involved, that idea of switching guitars and having silence feels, to me, has always felt like kind of like scary. It's the scariest thing of all, because I'm like, I don't know how this is going to go. No one wants to see this. No one. And actually, and my wife has helped me a lot with this, is being like, just being like, you know, people don't really, they're not really there. Like, they're taking a break too. You know,
yeah,
that's okay. They get to breathe. Sometimes they might even have a glass of water too. Like, I was so obsessed with that. Everything was cooking. And then I started to see more experienced players who would take these breaks, not giant ones, but just give themselves a bit of breathing room. And I'm going, wow, do I think they're at ease? So the audience is at ease. The minute they start getting nervous, then everything starts to rain. Then the audience gets nervous.
Yeah, what I'm finding interesting now is, like, I played one acoustic guitar. I only owned one guitar for the last like 10 years, and that's what I played live, and I never took it off. And now I'm finding, you know, with these newer songs, having to play in different tunings, and I'm playing more electric. The process of taking the guitar off feels like, you know, I'm removing some of my clothing, like not having the guitar on you as like a comfort blanket. That's a weird thing. It's just like, I'm trying to live more in that space of like not even having a guitar on me while I'm, you know, while I'm changing. And like, that's like a very vulnerable space for me, I'm finding. But yeah, you're right. As long as you're projecting some amount of comfort, then they're okay.
The confidence. It's just hard to have enough confidence to drop all those things that we really rely on, like a guitar and like silence. You know, just like a bit of space, but it's not easy. And you play electric now, right? Like, you tour solo, you play electric solo too, right?
Yeah, I'm finding that most of the shows are now almost all electric now. And that was just dictated from just kind of the new sound of the record and these low tunings that I'm playing in. And also, I mean, I listened to your and Jim's podcast where he said I sold him out on giving away all his guitar secrets, which is totally true. But it's because people keep asking, like, dude, how do you get your guitar tone like from your record? And I'm like, well, it's Jim's. I'm playing Jim's guitars, and they're his tones. And so after a while, I was like, oh, I'd kind of like to recreate this in my own live show. So Jim was very kind in helping me out with my setup, and now I just want to give him the credit because he doesn't take the credit. He's actually a pretty humble guy, but
he is. But he's a wealth of knowledge.
He is. He really is. And it's funny because he won't take credit for anything. I mean, he's made my last three records, and he's played most of the instruments on them. And somebody came up to me at a show recently and said, they said, hey, did Jim Bryson help you out with your records? And I'm like, yeah, he made the last three records and played most of the instruments on them. He's like, that's funny, because I asked him about it and Jim just said, I helped.
yeah.
It's like, yeah, you gotta take some more credit for this.
Yeah, own it. No, it's funny because, but you know what, like, they sound so great. The records sound great. I love how Jim makes records. I love the way his records sound. They're so clear. To me, they're just so clear. I love that they're reduced in all the right ways. Reduced in a good way, as in they're clean. Like, they feel like the essentials are all there, and the decorative elements are minimal in kind of the nicest way possible. It's like, okay, here's the fundamental. I'm gonna make it sound deluxe, and so there's all this. I was so drawn to your records, to his records. I mean, I've known his records for a long time, but he's, you know, it's really dialed in. I love how it sounds. I just really love the playing and the way it's all built.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I can't quit him as a producer, apparently, because I made three records with him. But, it's amazing how he does it without you knowing it too. Like, sometimes you'll just sit there and he'll be adding all these things and he'll be tweaking all these things. And you're sitting there going like, I don't know if I like that, but he doesn't. There's not really a conversation there about it. He's just doing it because he knows it's the right thing, and he doesn't want to acknowledge it because he knows it's right. And he knows, you know, once he's finished with that process, that you're going to love it. And that's always what happens, is you're sitting there going like, I don't know if we need that in there or whatever. And then when it all comes together, you're like, oh shit, I didn't even realize you were doing this to the song. So it's all very internal with him. Which I always find, now that we've made three records together, like, now I have that faith that he is doing that. But yeah, it's really interesting to watch him work like that. And I, for me, I just, yeah, I love watching him work, and and his style is just very different than mine. So I kind of just love how like he approaches the guitar versus how I approach it, and then bringing those two things together always creates something that I personally think just sounds nice and warm on the ears.
It really does. And now, how much of the song stuff, like when you're going in with the songs, how much of the pre-pro involves kind of songs, you know, working on the songs, basically just like chipping away? Or is it just kind of you come in, songs are done? Or is it kind of like, oh, maybe we should tighten up the pre-chorus, maybe we should double the choruses, what's the, you know, maybe we should try a different key, maybe we should take out some of the minor chords and add some whatever. Like, is there any of that going on?
A little bit. I mean, mostly the songs are done when I bring them in, and there's not really a lot of pre-production chat. I think Jim just kind of likes to dive in and let the players do their thing, and then come back to the structure later. There's a couple of songs where we either like took out sections or added an extra verse or a bridge. So there's a few structural things, but they usually happen once we've kind of been digging into it, and Jim just kind of likes to let everybody do their thing and let them come up with their ideas first, and then he kind of sits there and assesses it based on everybody else's ideas, and then he comes in and has suggestions from there. But mostly the songs are pretty finished by the time I bring them in.
Yeah, wow, great. I mean, the songs are so good. I got to go back to, I'm curious to know that you went to the Berklee now. So was that a 4-year, like how'd that look, and how has that influenced your life as a musician? I'm always kind of like, yeah. I'm always curious because I always wanted, there was part of me that always wanted to go to music school. I really did. Like, I was a trumpet player. I kind of dreamed of it. So when I hear of other songwriters who went that route, went to music school, I'm always just, and obviously Berklee is a particularly different type of school, and that, you know, it's not like a jazz school. You know, if you go to McGill, it's kind of classical or jazz or whatever. It's mm-hmm. obviously a really wide ranging program. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question everybody's interested in, it's a complicated subject for me because it's something I try not to like be at the forefront. But actually for me, I really needed it. I'm such a late bloomer in like all facets of my life, especially with my career. It's just like, I'm always kind of late to the party on everything. And with Berklee, it was kind of the same. Like, I needed those full 4 years just to figure out what I, you know, wanted to do. I went there just basically with total ignorance, just knowing that it was one of the better music schools, and I was just a guitar player, didn't even play in bands really, just kind of a basement guitar player, and somehow got in. I still don't even know how I got in, because I wasn't really that good of a guitar player. And then once I was there, tried to just figure out what I wanted to do, and by my third year I was like, well, I should maybe try to write a song. So I took a songwriting course. I hadn't written a song until I was about 20. And the first songwriting class I took, I thought they were just going to like study songs and, you know, take apart rhymes and verses and stuff. And in the first week they were like, all right, next week we're going to bring in a song and we're going to, you know, we're going to read through the lyrics and we're going to talk about it. And I hadn't written anything. So like sort of lit the fire under my ass to start writing songs and
share them. But, so you had to bring them share in them. and then have them like broken down in front of a class.
Yeah, it was terrifying. Holy. It was so terrifying. And I brought in a really bad song. I think it was called Flying Bicycle. And and I brought in a lot of bad songs in those first months, and it was terrifying. It was like one of the scariest few months of my life, I think, just trying to write from nothing. But eventually the song started getting better and the feedback started getting better, and I started kind of falling in love with it and becoming a bit obsessed with it. And so I think for me, if I hadn't gone there, I don't even know if I'd be doing music anymore. I think some people go to Berklee, you know, as a finished product. Like, I was there at the same time as Adrienne Lenker from Big Thief. And she was already a finished product. She had these songs, and you saw her, and you were like, "What do you even need? what are you even doing here? Like, you're ready for this. Whereas I was just, I needed that 4 years in that community and that kind of safe space just to figure it out. And that's what's, I think the best thing about Berkeley is just a lot of the people that I still, am friends with now are part of that songwriting community that, that I met there. And those are the people that I get my feedback from, since I'm mostly writing by myself. And, so I've got people that I can send songs to and just, you know, ask them, hey, is this good? And get actual honest feedback, which I think is super important as a songwriter, to have somebody who's not so afraid good. To tell you if something sucks.
And so you have that community of, in that group, you're still connected to them. You're still sending them stuff and going, hey, what do you think of this?
Yeah. There's one person in particular, my friend, Brian Dunn, who's an amazing songwriter. He lives in New York, and, yeah, we met at Berkeley and we've toured a lot together since, and I lived in New York for a while, close to him. And yeah, since then we've just, even if I have a half ass idea, I send it to him just to be like, is this something I should keep pursuing? And it's really nice to have that, you know, immediate feedback, but also honest feedback from somebody saying like, nah, maybe put this one away. And, and a lot of times it's something that I think is terrible, and I'll send it to him and he'll tell me, you know, it's a keeper. So that's super valuable to have that, I think.
Hmm. And so what I'm really curious about is like, what does songwriting instruction look like? You know, like what were some of the, how did they teach a group of people? What are some of the things that you took away from that? I'm always interested to know how it is taught, because it does seem like a process of discovery.
Yeah. Well, here, I mean, these are some of the things that I have some issues with about teaching songwriting, because yeah, I think a lot of songs can be good on paper, you know, structurally, lyrically, but just for whatever reason, they're just not good. You know, there needs to be some sort of essence to a good song that is kind of unexplainable, I think. But it does kind of teach you the tools to use, like when you're stuck, which is nice. You know, we basically study, just look at other songs, figure out what's going on, like why do I like this song? What's happening in the song? What's the rhyme scheme? What's the structure? Is it, you know, verse, refrain, verse, chorus? And you're just basically looking at songs and saying like, what's in the song that makes me like it? Like what's going on? Is it something in the rhyme scheme? Is it something in the melody? Is it something in the structure? So you just kind of start to learn like what you personally like in a song, and you start to notice it in other songs. You start to notice like, oh, they didn't rhyme here. That's really interesting. They dropped a bar here. That's really interesting. Like rhythmically, it moves the song forward. You know, you learn about what's it called? Prosody, which is like, you know, the sound of the song sounds like what's being sung.
Prosody.
Like if it's sung. Prosody, I think that's the word.
Yes.
No, so it's like if you've got a song about like rain and the song sounds rainy, you know,
okay.
That's
yeah.
Prosody.
Okay.
I'm doing a terrible job of explaining it, I'm sure, but it's just little things like that. And it helps when somebody, it really does help to kind of look at each other's songs, and even if they're bad songs, to just say like, what, you know, what could be done to make this work better. And, just picking things apart for the most part. But I do think, I think it is tricky, because songwriting is such a personal thing, and it is really hard to kind of, pick somebody's song apart and tell them that it's not good, you know? That is a challenging thing. And that was a difficult thing in navigating at Berkeley. It was just like not insulting the person while you're trying to tell them, you know, maybe try this. But
well,
I do
also
think,
and have that done to your songs. I mean, just becoming yes. less precious with your own material. That's such a hard process. I'm still working on it after working with so
it
many
is.
Different producers and having my songs all chopped, you know, like just crushed. You know,
yeah,
there's still part of me that just like, you know, it still hurts a little bit. So, I mean, I think that idea of actually being exposed to that for a few years at a young age is probably pretty healthy, pretty great, actually.
It was, especially for me being so green. Like, I was so open to the feedback. I wasn't precious about anything, because I was just like, this sucks. I'm terrible at songwriting. I didn't start until I was 20. So I just kind of, I really admired all these other people who had been writing songs since they were early teenagers. And so it was an amazing place for me to learn about that and to grow. Yeah. So I was really open to the feedback, but I remember there being some people that were not quite as open to that feedback. But there are still, I still use those tools now, like when I'm stuck, just knowing like, you know, what if I don't rhyme everything here? Maybe I drop a bar here. Or just little tricks like that keep you from getting stuck. So it was, for me, it was really important. It was a really important place for me, but I can see why it wouldn't work for everybody.
I'm fascinated by that though. I think it's great. I think it's so great. That's what a school should do. You know, that's what that experience should do, is open you up to that, make you, you know, bring you into a community, support you, teach you about songs. I mean, that's just, it's very, very different. Now, obviously you kind of alluded to it, but when you started writing songs, then after being a guitar player, you were kind of like, oh, this is the thing I want to do. It's like, I'm not going to be Shredmaster 2000. Yeah,
I tried Shredmaster 2000. I took a couple courses with a guy named Don Tappin Lappin, who was like a tapping guy. That wasn't for me. I took some jazz courses. That was not for me. Don't like a lot of chords. Once the songs got better, there was no looking back from there. It was just kind of full speed ahead ever since then. And again, like you said, I think the best part about a place like Berkeley is just that community, just that, we all took it so seriously. You know, we'd share each other's songs and we'd take the feedback very seriously and we'd take the songwriting very seriously. And of course, like, you know, we all thought we were going to graduate and immediately all, you know, make it big, which didn't happen. But I think that just that community and taking it so seriously was good for us in the long run. And of course there, we took our hits after that, but.
Yeah. But I think you have to fundamentally believe the best writing and the best community, I think, is that which believes it's going to change the world. You know, that is, yep. It is going to have a big impact. You know, being in a group of people that are like, let's go, these are the best songs the world has ever seen, even if it's not the case, is absolutely essential. It's like a real motivating force to write. You probably wrote a ton because you got that feeling.
So
you get that feeling of like, okay, we're moving the needle here. You start to get in the other side of things when you're like, none of my songs make a difference. Man, it's a lot harder to finish those songs.
Absolutely. No, it was amazing for me. Just meeting those types of people too, because growing up in London, like I said, I wasn't playing in bands or anything. So I wasn't connecting with other musicians. Like I was a jock in high school. I ran track. I played basketball. All my friends were jocks. Like they didn't play music. So it was just something I did on the side. And then what's interesting is like, once I moved to Berkeley, I just kind of gravitated towards those jock kind of people, those personalities. And then once I found the songwriting crew, I was just like, oh, these are my people. These are like thoughtful, sensitive, people that are, you know, there's no toxic masculinity, that kind of shit. It was just like, I was like, oh my God, this is the world I want to live in. And, so for me, it was huge, huge place to grow in. And, it's funny. I just played in Boston back in the fall and there were a bunch of Berkeley kids there that have been listening to the newest record. And it was so cool to be around that energy. You know, where I graduated in 2011. So it's been a while since I've been back there. And it was so cool to be around that energy again, because now, you know, now I'm jaded and angry at the world.
So, it's essential. The thing we don't think we need is the thing we need the most, which is being around young people.
Absolutely. And they're so supportive of each other. And they're better.
And it's so easy as you get older to be like, oh, you know, whatever. Like you start, that's what cynicism is. It's like, that is by definition cynicism. And it is also what happens to every generation. And I'm like, I'm not going to be like that. And then I start getting like that and I'm scared.
Right. I know.
And then
it's
I
easy
go
to
do something with university students and I'm like, oh, I'm not going to fit in, or they're, you know, I'm not, it's not going to work, or something is, the world has changed and I'm not going to be And then I'm like, I leave and I'm like, this is better. The world, these students are incredible. And I feel the same way. I'm like, this is such an inspiring, the thing I didn't think I needed, the thing I thought I was going to be excluded and feel like a relic or whatever, actually was like ignites this fire. I'm really trying to do it more now. I'm quite aware of it now, being like, whoa, I misjudged that. Just how important it is around to be around youthful energy. And I'm only 41.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to do more of it too, just because I realized in that moment, like, you know, I do make a lot of my music in a very isolated place and isolated mindset, and it's easy to just sit here and be angry about things. So, I feel like it was, I might be wrong about this, but I feel like there was still a lot of competition, you know, when I was coming up with people. And the young kids I've been around now, it doesn't seem like they're like competitive with each other. It seems like they're all very supportive, and it seems like a very healthy,
oh, that's cool,
healthy place. So I'm trying to tap into that a little bit more and spend more time around it. And, not be so grouchy all the time.
You're grouchy, eh?
A little bit, you know. I can get a little grouchy about the state of things, but
yeah.
It's hard not to.
It is. It is, and then that's what happened. You know, what I mean, but it is important. I've seen that beautiful, that trio of singers, Habits, Little Tiny Habits. No,
Tiny Habits. Yeah,
Tiny Habits.
Yeah,
unbelievable. And they sing one of your like they're so huge. I find them incredible. Anybody who's listening should go and listen to that group, because you think that every harmonic possibility has been sung in the world. I'm like, there's no way three singers who are singing harmony are going to impress. I don't mean to say impress me, but I'm going to be like, yeah, ooh, they sing really in tune. That's really beautiful. They're right. Doing different things. Like at points I'm hearing harmonic, these moments of unison and then incredibly tight harmony that I'm like, what is happening? And it is, It's like some of the most interesting harmonic stuff I've heard in a long time. And I follow them. I'm watching their videos on Instagram. And then they sing one of your songs. And I'm like, Ken, I mean, that's like a Grammy, bro. That's a good feeling.
Oh, my God. When I first heard the cover that, Judah did from that group. And now it's funny that you mentioned them, because they just sent me a video yesterday. They're singing on, I'm going to re-release a different version of a song from the latest record, and they're going to sing on it. And they sent me a little clip yesterday, and yeah, I mean, it sounds amazing. But when he first posted the cover, I was on a canoe trip, of course, very, very
good.
Yeah. Very, typical for me, but, I had just a little bit of service, and I saw he posted it, and yeah, I had kind of seen some of the things they'd done before, and I was so excited to listen to it, but I had no service. So my trick is like to put the phone in a cup, and somehow you get better service. And that still wasn't working, but I heard like a little clip and it sounded so good. I was so excited. So I paddled out into the middle of the lake to like get better service. And I was like, you guys got to hear this. This is amazing. but yeah, ever since then, I've been chatting with them.
The Canadian experience.
So Canadian. Yeah. Then I've just stayed in touch with them, and they're incredible. And they came to that show, and Judah came up to sing on a song, and yeah, their energy and, they're just such, everyone's so talented, it seems like, these days. All these kids are so talented. Like, people have been posting posting some covers, especially in that Berklee world. I've been getting sent a bunch of covers, and everybody's such a good singer these days. I don't know what's going on, but they're all amazing, and they're all super supportive of each other, I'm trying to tap into, because I think it'll be good for me in the long run.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad. I mean, it is remarkable how talented. I mean, I love that. I think about my younger self looking, you know, being so curious about great players and everything else. And now you really can see players from all around the world. I think that's what's happening too, is they're motivating each other, whether they know each other or not, they feel connected to one another. So the playing is just extraordinary.
It's crazy, man. And I think people are like, everyone's got their like studio spaces figured out at a young age. Like, I didn't know when I went to Berklee, I didn't even know that you could like edit vocals. I thought you just like sang into a mic and that was it. Like, I knew nothing about recording or anything. And so it's taken me over 10 years just to figure out how to make like a really good sounding demo. So, but these kids all seem to have it tapped into it. They've got their setup. They've, everything sounds great, and they can make stuff for cheap, which I think is, I think that's a huge part of it too, right? Is you don't need to spend all this money being in a studio. You can just make really nice sounding stuff at home. And
Yeah. They're not in that situation where, they are. And they're out engaged and connecting with an audience, whether they have all the gear or not. So many people are waiting around for the right gear, for the right studio to pop up. Whereas like the ones who are doing things are out there just doing it. They're connecting. They're doing it on a phone. I mean, that Tiny Habits band is like, that's not even recorded on microphones most of the time. It's literally in a stairwell with their phone. And you're like, right, works for me.
It sounds amazing. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. I'm totally moved by it, you know? But yeah, I mean, I find there's so many things I want to ask you about. Like, I've just from even just digging in a little musically to what you do. First of all, you're like a verse master in my mind. You've got great choruses, but everybody, you know, choruses, people seem to be able to do well. Some people, you've got great verses, man. I'm glad to hear that it takes you time and that it's hard. I'm really glad, because if you said it was just easy, I was going to be really pissed.
Oh, no, it's not. It's not easy. Honestly, I think, you know, I don't know. I don't consider myself a singer or that good of a guitar player. I think my skill is just not giving up on the lyrics until I'm happy with it. Like I won't stop until I'm happy with it. And it's excruciating, but I think that's my skill. It's just spending a lot of time on it. So I have poor time management skills, but I think that's what works for me. And
just do not give up.
I just don't give up, which sometimes is to my own detriment. Cause sometimes you're spending time on a song that probably doesn't deserve the time, but that means a lot. It's weird because I mostly start with verses. I know a lot of people start with choruses, and I always seem to just kind of start from the start of the song, and that's how I write it. It's rare that I'll have a chorus first. So I'm always a little self-conscious about my choruses because I don't write in that way, and I end up actually just avoiding choruses sometimes and just having kind of verses that lead into refrains.
It's just so interesting, because literally that was like my songwriting question for you, is like, when do you decide to leave your verse? I don't know. There's very few songwriters that I know where I'm not like, there's some of your songs have multiple verses.
Yeah.
Like they go beyond the two verse. They go beyond the kind of two verse chorus thing. And I'm like, but I'm very engaged. I'm saying this as a compliment, where I'm like, I still want more verses. It doesn't happen. Like, again, this is the mystery of songwriting, right? As you said, like, you can't, it's not a formula. I listen to your songs and I'm like, I am chilling in this verse and I'm good to hear a few more. And so it's so interesting to say that you're self-conscious with the chorus thing, because I'm like, every once in a while, I'm like, so when do you decide? Like, what makes you decide to go to the chorus? Like, sometimes it feels like you're not in a rush. I think that's part of the reason why I love your songs, is that you're not in a rush.
Oh, thank you. That's really cool. I think for me, like, I don't really like a lot of chords. I find with my guitar playing, I want to play stuff that's comfortable on my hands. Like, I don't want to work that hard. And so I think the verses just come out of me just finding kind of a chord progression or a groove that I like, and I just kind of want to sit in it for a while and not go anywhere. And most of the times I do avoid going somewhere, and I only go somewhere because I think I need to.
I knew it. But, I knew it.
I'm about to release a song that's kind of a B-side from Cerulean, and it doesn't have a chorus, and I'm worried that it's, I'm anxious to hear your input on it, because
if anybody can pull it off, if you can, I never would say that. I just generally would not believe it. I'm a big fan of choruses. I'm a pop, I love pop music, you know, but I listen to your music and I'm like, it's a very funny thing that you say that, because it was a nerdy observation where I'm like, I get the sense that he's not in a rush to get to the chorus in a good way. And it doesn't put me, again, it's a bit of the ease thing, right? It's a bit of the thing of like taking time on stage.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like you're in a rush to get to the chorus. Every once in a while you hear certain songs, lots of songs, and everybody's guilty of it, where you end up rushing because you think you need to be getting to the chorus rather than accepting the natural flow of the song, the natural right. energy, the natural mystery, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. Cause yeah, I've got this song that's got, it's got two verses and then it takes a big instrumental break with the same chord progression. And then it has a third verse and then basically goes to two bridges. So there's really no chorus. And then this is also, I mean, to bring it back to Jim, like this was some of his input too, was we would always, on a lot of songs, we would fight over whether it was a chorus or a bridge, because in my mind, a chorus didn't even, like, I have a song called Don't Mean to Wake You. And in my mind, it's verse, chorus, bridge. But Jim was, what I thought was the chorus, Jim was saying, like, no, this is the pre-chorus. Yes. The chorus is coming later. Like, no, that's a bridge. He's like, no, this is the chorus, even though you don't get to it until like a third of the way through the song. But
right.
but I'm glad to hear you say that, because I do think about sometimes, like, you know, like if whether I should start trying to write with a chorus first, because I know that
in my opinion, that's my thoughts. Is if I'm going to be part of your feedback team, you've got a good thing going on, and I've noticed it. I noticed it right away that you have, and I think a lot of people could, if you know, from an instructional perspective, what you could teach other songwriters is this idea that if it feels right, if it feels easy,
yeah,
you're generally sitting in something that's good, right? You're talking about just playing those chords that make your hands feel good at a tempo that feels good.
Right.
That's a good thing, right? You're at ease. Yeah. The audience is at ease. There's something that's happening there. And this is why I found I've been listening to your stuff all the time. I mean, it feels so natural. And I love when songs like that make me, it feels new, but natural. And that's a challenge, right? You're talking about, you're not like you're playing, as you said, like you're not inventing new chords.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you know, I appreciate that.
It's not like it's not all diminished chords and crazy. It's not. It's actually structurally, it makes you realize, like, sometimes if the foundation is strong enough, you can sit in it and be confident to sit in it.
Well, I appreciate that. I think it's dictated a lot by what I'm listening to too. You know, like I was talking about, you know, playing all those house concerts and writing songs that were maybe not songs in a genre that I would even listen to. And so what was nice about that pandemic break was I actually sat down and said, like, you know, let's try to make some music that, that I would actually listen to, you know? And a lot of that for me is like, you know, my songs are not necessarily happy. They don't have happy lyrics or happy ideas or even a happy sound to them. But, you know, a lot of my favorite songs are songs that, you know, they do have a lot to chew on lyrically. They're, you know, they're very dark and they have a message in them, but you can still put that record on while you're making dinner and not feel shitty and not feel sad, you know. Yeah. Or even sometimes it's even a volume thing. Like sometimes I don't want to put on a record where there's a lot of volume change between the songs, you know, if it's too quiet in an acoustic number and then it goes into a loud rocker, like sometimes that doesn't feel good to me on the ears. So I've been listening a lot to like Kurt Vile, who talk about not having any choruses. Like sometimes it's just, he's just vamping for 7 minutes but it's still, that still sounds good to my ears. And I, you know, if you look closer at the lyrics, like he's really saying some shit, but it's also a record that I would put on for, you know, if I had people over, you know? So that was kind of a conscious thing that I wanted, you know, we had a couple songs where, when we were talking about the direction, everyone was like, you know, well, this is the ballad. Maybe this should be mostly acoustic, no drums, no bass. And we kind of revisited it to be like, you know, how can we make this groove?
Yes.
That's more interesting to me. I want to make this really super sad, emotional song groove a little bit so that, you know, you still want to listen to it while you're hanging out.
Yeah. Yeah, it sits. It just sits in a really specific place. I love that. I love, and I was curious to know who your influences have been. And like, even when you started listening, I mean, I don't know if you were you listening to much music when you were playing basketball and doing track? Was that more, or has it been like, were you a music fanatic as a youngster?
I was, yeah, but my taste was terrible. So I was listening to like alternative rock. I was like,
okay.
big into like
That is terrible.
No, yeah, it's really bad. I was really into like Incubus as a teenager.
Oh yeah,
I was really cool. Into them. Yeah, yeah. And so again, late bloomer to late to the party on everything. Like I didn't have that person because I hung out with mostly jocks. I didn't have somebody like giving me records and saying like, dude, you got to listen to this.
But Incubus is kind of interesting, isn't it? Kind of proggy.
Sure. Oh yeah, I mean it's proggy. Like it has elements. Yeah. It has elements that, you know, probably they're probably still ingrained in me somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But you know, I remember thinking like, I didn't listen to a full Beatles record until I went to Berkeley. Like I just thought the Beatles, like I knew the hits, you know, but I didn't. I never listened to Abbey Road, and then so it wasn't until I went to Berkeley and actually had musicians being like, "No, dude, sit down." I remember somebody played me the medley from Abbey Road and I was like, oh, okay. Now I get it. I get the Beatles now. So I had a big awakening there with people being like, no, dude, this is what you need to listen to. So I always loved music, but my taste was a little strange. But my dad, you know, he had Neil Young and James Taylor on in the house. And so I still gravitated towards that kind of 70s folk thing. But, yeah, I didn't really, I don't know if I became like fully obsessed with like songs and songwriters until I went to Berkeley, which again, like if I hadn't gone there, who knows what I would have.
So I'm glad it's so interesting. Yeah. It's what it should do. I mean, it's funny how that, you know, there's a point in your life where you are listening to what shows up at your doorstep. You know, yeah. In your case, that was the alternative rock. That was it. That was what was happening.
Right. For me, it was classic like much rock music. Radio. Yeah.
For me, it was much music, which was great. Like, I mean, I still have so many great memories, and I still am very connected to Belle Biv DeVoe and like early R&B. Like, you know, that was my stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it wasn't. And then Guns N' Roses and all of that stuff. That was obviously like huge in my house and everything else. I got older brothers. But it wasn't until, you know, I had a friend who owned a record store that was like, hey, man, try this out. And then you're kind of like, oh, wait. There's more. I can actually have my own universe of music that isn't just the stuff that lands at my door. And sometimes it happens when you're 14. Sometimes it happens when you're 20, you know, and then it keeps on happening. Yeah. It keeps on happening.
It does. Yeah. But I think it is important to have that kind of spiritual music guide at some point in your life of just like kind of this person who is like, no, dude, this is what's it. You know, you got to listen to this. Because I never had that in my life growing up. It was just kind of, in London, Ontario, it was just like rock radio. That's all we had. So that's, you know, that's what I was. Yeah. And I think, you know, like listening to some of those early 2000s rock bands at least allowed me to look back at some of the like earlier rock bands. So, like, you know, I had some, you know, like I got into Radiohead pretty early on too. So that I'm sure that helped. But sometimes I look back on my musical upbringing and I'm like, oh my God, I think that's how
most people feel. And then, but then you know, the good news is that it opens up and then you realize that there's just so much stuff out there and not everything is to your taste. And then there's a whole other universe that is kind of particular to you, which I think is the exciting part, is finding that music that feels like, oh wait, this was made for me, you know?
Absolutely.
And of course it isn't just made for you. It's made for the whole group of people that also relate to that music. But that's very transformative. Whether it happens when you're 20 or when you're, you know, Lori Brown and I were just talking about that. And she was saying that when she heard Kate Bush and David Bowie, that was like, holy smokes, this is different.
Yeah.
You know, and it's special.
It is. Yeah. And it's still happening. You know, I'm still finding stuff that came out years ago that I've never heard. And I think that just keeps happening. And again, like that's a huge part of, I think, like if I'm stuck, like lately I feel like I've been very stuck songwriting. And so I've just been trying to find new music to just like kind of get me going a little bit, you know, inspire me a little bit and make me jealous. Sometimes you hear a really great song, like written by either somebody you know or somebody you don't know. And you go, oh shit, I wish I wrote that. And that's sometimes enough to.
Yeah. That's a great, I mean, it's so weird to hear you say that you're kind of like feeling like this. Cause this is probably the first time in my career, honestly, where I felt like, man, I'm not writing like I used to write. Like it's been a while and I've been thinking of the same thing. Like, man, I got to listen to some stuff that gets that fire under me. And sometimes it's not the stuff that's mind blowing. Sometimes it's the stuff that just feels out of reach. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't listen to Abbey Road. It doesn't inspire me. I right. love it. Bob Dylan doesn't inspire me for the most part because I'm like, I don't know how that happened. I right. don't know what happened there. That's magic beyond my grasp. Do you know what I'm saying? Like
absolutely.
Inspiration is often like, it has to do with what feels possible. I don't listen
what feels
to
possible. Yeah, listen. It's a song that you think, oh my God, I could have written that.
I could have written that.
Yeah. That's
I
that's
to
huge.
Justin Bieber, that Love Yourself song. Do you know that song?
Right. Yeah.
I heard that and I was like, that. Dude, this is like, and then in the trumpet solo, I was listening to it, this sounds like my song. This sounds like a song I could have written. Like, and it's a great yeah. song and it's a giant smash. And I remember being like, oh my gosh. And then the trumpet solo came and I'm like, I'm done. Like, I'm out. Like, this devastation, full devastation. I'm like, too little, too late, Miles. Time to pack it up. That was your opportunity. That was your chance.
Yeah, it's a shitty feeling, man. But it's also like it's a hard feeling in the moment. But it is what gets you to kind of lock yourself in a room and be like, and you can like I found that I could try to write almost note for note that song, and you'll still end up with something that sounds like you, right? So. You know, yeah. a lot of it is, you know, not ripping off things per se, but just saying like, I want to write a song like that and sitting down and trying to actually write something like that. And most of the time in that process, it becomes something completely different, but it is a song. So if you feel
yeah, right.
if you're feeling yeah, stuck, it's kind of helpful.
That's great. That's a great tip. You know, it's like, it's this thing about being loose and tight at the same time. I often make reference to the Buddhist mantra that, you know, when you walk across a room with a spoonful of water, if you hold it too tight, the water will spill. If you hold it too loose, the water will spill. And so the goal is to kind of like be somewhere in between the tightness and the looseness. And it's a bit like that with songs, right? You go in too tight, it's not going to happen. You go in too loose, you're not going to finish the song. It pertains to so many parts of my life that I use it all the time.
But yeah, I was going to say that it applies to everything.
I feel like it applies to everything. And I find it just like, and it's a meditation technique. It's very much tied to meditation because it's the same thing. If you sit and you're focused like crazy, you're just going to, it's horrible. Whereas if you know, it's this balance between being focused and not, you know, and loose. It's this really, and I find songwriting is a bit like that. And maybe it's because I'm feeling a little tight right now. You know, it's yeah. almost like I feel like I'm holding on too tight. Maybe I want the song too much.
I think that's a huge, it's so nice to hear you say that because I'm in the exact same boat and I've been talking to my wife a lot about just like that balance. You have to find, it's a constant battle just to find that balance. And yeah, when you really need a song, that's not when it's going to come, right? You just got to let it, happen. And it is hard, I think, because we had that space for a while and now everything is back and you know, everyone's going, what's next? And it just doesn't work like that. You can't just write a record in a day and every record is different and every song is different. And, you know, I'm still pretty stuck, but I still have hope that like, you know, the river starts flowing eventually.
That's right.
Right. Like
it's, yeah. That's right. When you're not looking.
Yeah.
My wife always says you got to go on vacation. That's when I write. Like yes. I go on vacation and all of a sudden I'm writing songs again. And I'm like, it's because I'm not looking right at the song.
That is also something that I've been talking about a lot. Cause we, you know, my wife and I had a rough couple of years, during the pandemic with some family stuff too. And after that we were like, you know what, like, let's just fucking go to Hawaii. And again, I have that like guilt immediately, like when we start booking the trip, I have guilt because I go, well, what if something comes up during that time that's really important? Like, I don't want to turn any opportunities down. But then I also have this guilt of like, you know, what are people going to think seeing me in Hawaii and, you know, realizing I'm not working. And then I have the guilt of allowing myself to relax and enjoy something. But I'm getting better at that now. I think it's important for everybody to take a vacation, take multiple vacations, get away when you can. Cause it really does help. And
well, especially when I come out of the vacation and I've written more songs than I did when I wasn't on vacation. And then right. I'm like, I've really got this productivity thing backwards.
Yeah.
Like if my job is to write songs, maybe my job is also to go on vacation. I don't know.
You know, like, I mean, absolutely. Songs come in different ways. Right. And like I said, sometimes I have all these, melodies and guitar parts. And so, you know, I can kind of work on it in my head for the most part. So sometimes all I need is just to relax and sit there for a while and just think about it. And sometimes you get, you know, a good lyric from that. And so, yeah, maybe we just need to take more vacations.
Yeah.
But I think it's also turning off, right? It's just, you just got to turn, like, again, what I said, I mean, for me, it's become very extreme, because for me to shut off all the noise, I need to, like, be out in the woods for 7 days with, like, no service. And, you know, like, that's, I'm finding it's getting more and more extreme, where I'm like, I just want to get further and further into the wilderness and spend longer times out there. But for me, it's just like, I just need to shut off that part of my brain that is listening to the noise, or is at least, like, it got my attention. I just need to, like, stop that for a while. And I always come back from that, like, in a way better headspace. But obviously it's getting a little extreme for me, so I don't know if that's a good thing.
It's great. So, I mean, heck, and your new song sounds incredible. I love it. Fairweather, that's a beautiful, beautiful song.
Oh, thanks, still, man.
So good. Thanks. So good. And I know there's more coming, right? You got a couple more songs?
Yeah, I got a couple more that were kind of like B-sides from Cerulean that I'm working on with Dan Ledwell. And we're going to do some, like, reworked versions of songs from Cerulean. So that's kind of sort of my way of trying to keep the record cycle going. Because it's, you know, these days it feels like when the record's out, like, it's done. So I'm just kind of trying to keep it in the zeitgeist for another year while I'm working on new stuff. And, you know, hopefully the songs start coming. They are starting to come now.
They're
now
coming, man.
Yeah.
I got total confidence in you. If that helps, at all, yeah. I'm not worried.
Thanks, man. I'm glad you're in the same boat.
I'm not worried about you.
No, you'll be good too. Yeah. When did your last record come out?
I put it out in the fall.
Right. Yeah.
I think
it's a great record, man.
It's hard because, you know, you put out singles and then, you know, so it was done. It was done a while ago, but it came out in the fall, and then we toured it. Yeah, it was a fun experience. It was, again, I was really tied to what I wanted to create. Very much tied to making music that I wanted to hear myself. And I've kind of stuck with that, and being in Fredericton has helped me. Me focus on that. And so I'm working. So I, you know, it's not, the river isn't flowing like crazy from the songs, but the songs that I'm working on, I'm stoked about, very stoked about. And I got a great group of people I'm making music with. So I'm not complaining, but it's just a different flow. And I'm excited to have it. Like, I'm excited for, like, a lot of songs just to, like, drop in my lap one of these days.
I'm sure they will. Like, sometimes it's just a wave, right? Like, three or four come at once. Are you making your records right there at home?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I make them at home. That's awesome. But I'm working at a distance, right? I send tracks around. And I work very closely with Josh Van Tassel. So Josh plays the drums on everything, and he produces the stuff with me. So he's like, he makes sense of my horrible Logic sessions. He is extraordinarily helpful in... Oh, he's amazing, and he's a really close friend, and there's a deep relationship there. And so I've worked this out through the pandemic, was being able to send tracks around to Dean Drouillard, who lives in Toronto, and Asa, who lives down in Nashville. And, you know, there's people in different spots, vocals that happen. It's at Halifax, Rainey and Haley. So it's really rad. I have this amazing – once that opened up, I was like, wait, I can move. I can be home. I can, like, live I can – be in Fredericton, and I can walk downtown and be in the woods every day, and then come down here and work and send tracks. And I'm making stuff that I'm really excited about with musicians I'm excited about in this way. So, and that opened up.
That's amazing.
I still love it. I love what we're doing. And again, it helps that Josh is a pro and can kind of make sense of, you know, things that come in. But a lot of people have great setups at home. So it's not like the tracks I'm getting are deluxe.
Yeah. It's amazing. Josh plays on
people have good setups.
Yeah, Josh plays on some of the new B-sides I'm releasing, and it was amazing just to send him something, and the drum sounds are amazing, and his playing's amazing. And I even, like, I sent him just, like, the crappiest demo where I'm not even playing in time that well, and he sends this, like, super, like, just really tight, amazing sounding drum part that needs, like, no editing, and it's amazing. And that was a big part of this record process for me too, is just figuring out that home setup that you could record a good enough vocal and guitar to send to other people. And that's actually been a really fun way of making records. Just it's allowed me to be a bit more creative, to just be able to send people stuff and see what they give back. Because I think, like, to them, like, they also probably enjoy creating in their own space too, and having time to, like, you know, think about what they want to play. And I think, yeah, I think it's a cool time to make music because of that. I think
it was a huge opening for me to realize that actually I was so tied to this idea of everybody being in the studio. We're so tied to that idea. And then all of a sudden I was like, you know, I actually think that, as you just said, for the players themselves, they're at ease. They're at home. They're doing it on their own time. They're taking risks, big risks. They're trying stuff out. Whereas if everybody's just sitting around, or you're playing live, everybody's kind of, sometimes they can actually be pretty reserved, or they feel like they're on the clock and every other musician in the studio is just watching them. That's both of those situations don't necessarily bring out the best. And so I've been really amazed with just, you know, how fun it's been. As everybody gets busier, it becomes a little bit trickier just getting everybody's time on, but, you know, like, just getting everybody in somewhat around. But that's okay. It's okay. It's been tremendous. I feel really lucky to have the keys to the car. I've never had the keys to the car before. I never made, you know, I've produced all these records with other people, and I never had that. I never had the tracks in front of me. I never got to, like, I didn't know what reverb was. Like, I knew what it sounded like. I didn't know that I could actually just put it on something. Blew my mind.
I'm the exact same. I went through that whole process. I was like, wait, I can do this on my own? And Jim lent me a vocal mic, which I ended up just buying off of him because I was having so much more, well, I don't know if I'd say it was fun, but, like, I was able to do all my vocals from home. And so to not have, like, a producer sitting there without that, you know, just listening to you do take after take and just having my own time to go up and do it was so freeing. I was like, I can't believe I could just do this in my closet. This is amazing.
I know. I love it too. And I'm excited. To hear, you know, what's next, Ken. I'm very excited for you, man. I really appreciate you doing this, taking this time. It's been awesome. Awesome to chat, man. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for having me. I'm a huge, huge fan of the podcast and your tunes. So I appreciate you having me, and I'm glad we could finally do it. And hopefully I'll meet you in person soon.
I can't wait. Let's go on a canoe trip or something, man.
Let's do it.
New Brunswick, there's some fine rivers. The Restigouche River is a very special river.
Oh, I've heard all about it. I've done all the research, so I'm there.
Okay, you just say the word, man. You say the word. All right, dude, thanks. Good, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Talk soon. Now that you know how he goes about writing the songs, his education, where he came to it all, you know, go ahead and listen to his music. It will make it even better. It will make it even better. He's a charming dude, incredibly smart, and really fun to chat with. I was excited about that because ultimately that's what I'm about. I'm all about songwriting. I'm all about making music and what makes people tick and how they go about it, how they stay creative, how they stay focused through the years. And so I'm always curious to have these conversations, especially with artists that I've never spoken with, like Ken. I was curious to know how it was going to go, and I was just thrilled that we got a chance to chat. So thank you, Ken, and thank you for listening. But please, go check out Ken's music, kenyates.com. He's on all the streaming services, of course. Go buy an album. Cerulean's his last record. Before that, Quiet Talkers. Got some singles that are just coming out now, produced by Danny Ledwell. Also, really, really great stuff. Remember, I'm on Instagram at David Miles, M-Y-L-E-S. I'm on Twitter at Miles David. So, get in touch. Appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back soon with more episodes of the Miles From Home podcast. Take care of yourselves. Peace.